Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Over the past decade, Rome has been marked with sharp and often unwarranted criticism of the church in the United States and American Catholic life. Very few of the critics have taken the time to talk systematically with a wide range of United States Catholics or Catholic clergy to understand their concerns, their cultural situations, and most of all, their commitment to Rome and the Magisterium. Francis Mayer has had those conversations, and he has compiled them into this wonderful work that we're talking about today. Francis X. Mayer is a senior fellow in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He served for 23 years as senior aide and special assistant to Archbishop Charles Chaput, Order of Franciscans Minor Capuchin, in Denver and Philadelphia, and he previously served for 15 years as editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register News Weekly, and earlier still as a screenwriter and story analyst based in Los Angeles. Fran, glad to have you in the program.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, the honor's all ours. And so I read this book, frankly, with quite a bit of surprise because I look up what the book is about before I read it. I just started diving right into it, and I didn't expect the format of 103 interviews just kind of laid out back to back, which really prompts my first question. It's a very unique way and yet a very comprehensive way to present the story of the church here in the United States. And I want to ask you what prompted the thought process behind the structuring of this book.
Well, you know, that's a really good question, and I'm glad you raised it right at the beginning, because I think people sometimes get afraid of a book that is primarily interviews. And, you know, I've worked in the church my entire career. I mean, I think it's 46 years now. And it's typical for the Catholic commentariat to have a lot of opinions about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly I publish my own all the time. But it occurred to me that it might be really good to actually ask real people outside the standard professional Catholic bubble what they actually thought about issues. And so I did that. I spent 3 years basically doing it. You know, I don't think there are 103. I did 103 interviews. Not all of them made it into the book, obviously, or the thing would be 1,000 pages. But the 30 bishops, something like 60 lay people from all sorts of different backgrounds, priests, deacons, and religious. And they're condensed interviews, obviously, for the same reason. I mean, you don't want to try to sell a book of 1,000 pages, but they're enormous number of really faithful people out there who have good things to say, including some significant criticism of the church in the United States. And I think when people outside the United States look at us, they frequently misunderstand what the church in the United States is about. They certainly misunderstand the quality of leadership that we have in our bishops, because so much of the last 20 years has been consumed in the secular media by the clergy abuse crisis, and appropriately so at one level. But the faith of the church is still very strong, and people need to hear stories of hope as well as criticism. And I think that what emerges from this book, or I hope it does, is a sense that, the church in the United States is actually pretty strong. And there are a lot of enormously faithful people who are doing really good things. And we need to hear that so that our hearts don't grow cold.
Right. I must comment that there really is a burgeoning, bubbling series of pockets, if you will, of the faith truly thriving and growing and expanding here in the United States of America. And it's the kind of thing that's benefiting not just the nation, but the common good of the world at large. I myself am a recipient of it. Malaysia is by no means a place where magisterial truth thrives or is even available in some regards. It's difficult to get good books into the country. But because of the work that's done here in the United States of America by the church in America and lay movements in America, conversions are happening across the world. So there's something unique about the church in the United States of America. And just talk about some of the reasons why you think that is.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's a good question as well. I mean, I think part of the American Catholic personality is the fact that we were never really part of this country. I mean, this country is a creature, kind of a mixed marriage of biblical morality and rationalist thought, and particularly Protestant religious consciousness and the Enlightenment. And there's not a lot of room in either of those strains of thought for the Catholic Church. Both of them were reactions to what they perceived as abuses by the Catholic Church. So Catholics in this country were never welcome, and they were particularly unwelcome when the immigrant waves of the 19th century happened. So you had, I live in Philadelphia, and there were terrible riots against Catholics in the Philadelphia area. So what does that do? What that does among Catholics is create a history of fidelity to the Church, and particular fidelity to Rome, because Rome was seen as this kind of protector across the ocean. So there's that hardwired into the American Catholic environment, and I think it explains the zeal a lot of Catholics feel for their faith, even now, even in a very secular environment, and kind of a generosity and an enduring fidelity to Rome, even if they, whatever they think about the current pope or the last pope or popes five popes ago, Catholics have traditionally been very loyal to Rome because they just have that cultural memory of being a mission church and relying very heavily on Rome.
You know, part of this experience, Fran, of being the so—I'm coining this term, and you might disagree with me as to the strength of it—but being this kind of redheaded stepchild of the American culture, we belong to this nation, and yet we don't really belong to the nation.
Right.
Part of that experience, however, is also this underlying appreciation for the fact that everything that's good about Western civilization and everything that's good about the United States culture and constitution and nation as a whole comes from the heritage of Judeo-Christianity as found in Roman Catholicism. It forms the bedrock framework of everything we know to be true, good, and beautiful about the nation. So somehow implicitly we understand that, even if that's not explicitly told in the public sphere.
Yeah, well, you know, the founders, not all of them were Christians, some of them are deists, obviously, but they all operated out of a biblical framework.
Yep.
I mean, there was no real atheism. I think one of the founders was claimed to be an atheist, but the morality, the profound and dominant morality, was biblical and very specifically Christian. It's one of the reasons that Catholics could, in fact, fit in the United States, was that we were, you know, Protestants and Catholics had a bad track record from the Reformation in treating each other, but we still did have 80% of our common faith, which was, you know, basic Christianity, that enabled us to make a place here for ourselves. You can't understand the success of the United States and the success of the West without understanding the profound role Christianity had in both the formation of Western culture and specifically the formation of the American personality.
Mm-hmm. So, Fran, in your research, and like you said, you took 3 years to do this painstaking series of interviews, you clearly gained a lot of insight into what's going on in the church in the United States of America. I think I might be overstretching this truth in saying this, but I don't think I'm wrong here. I think very few people outside of you have a true finger on the pulse of the zeitgeist of what's going on in the church in the United States. So just share with us, what do you think are some of the core undercurrents?
I think there's a couple of things. First of all, there are a lot of people that are smarter than me, but I don't think there are a lot of people that have had the kind of experience that I've had over the past 46 years in the church, because I've had the privilege of working with a huge number both of lay people and priests, but also intimately with a variety of bishops, and seen how their lives actually are lived and the kind of pressures that they're under and the decision making that they have to do. So in that sense, I mean, it has been a real blessed career, because I've had an insight into things that maybe some other people have not. Having said that, I mean, I think there are two things. Number one, we underestimate and therefore defeat ourselves when we underestimate The energy in the church and the positive action in the church. There are enormous numbers of ministries in this country that are doing really good work, and they never get attention because we tend to focus on the negatives, and the secular culture certainly wants us to do that. So, I mean, if you look at FOCUS, for example, you know, Fellowship of Catholic University Students, or the Augustine Institute, or the Leonine Forum, or hundreds of Catholic radios, look at what you're doing right now. I mean, these are things that are expressions of vitality and hope. They're not expressions of corpses. So that's one thing that we need to hang on to. The other thing, though, is that there's, I think there's been a strategic error in the in the American church that is understandable, but now is really a negative. And that is that because we were a rejected minority in this country, the church took the position of trying very, very hard to be accepted, to fit in, to assimilate, to prove that we were really good Americans. I mean, that's Stanley Hauerwas, the wonderful Methodist theologian, has that joke about one of the reasons that for so long there were a disproportionate number of Catholics in the FBI and the CIA and the Marine Corps was because we were trying very hard to prove that we were good Americans. And there was a lot of truth to that, you know. Now, that's a good thing to a certain degree, but where that's led us is instead of converting the culture, we've been digested by it because we've been very successful. And when you're digested, this specifically, you know, the unique things about Catholic, about being Catholic, the missionary and evangelical quality of being Catholic is bleached out in the process of assimilation and digestion. And I think that's, I think Catholics need to recognize that we're, that this isn't our home. It's never going to be our home, and we need to take a much more active sense. We need to have a much more active sense that this is now real mission territory, and that we need to keep a proper separation between our appropriate patriotism and our deeper patriotism to our real home, which is not the United States, but heaven.
Right. And even as you said that, I can imagine the sentiments of some people listening feeling a little jarred. But in fact, that's our true patria. That's where we owe our first and final allegiance, our heavenly homeland. And so everything we enjoy here in the United States is an extension of it. Thank you so much. We're going to continue this conversation with Francis Mayer, Senior Fellow in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about his newest book published by Ignatius Press entitled True Confessions, Voices of Faith from a Life in the Church. For Cresta in the Afternoon, I'm Marcus Peter. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. My guest, Francis Mayer, Senior Fellow in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and his book, True Confessions, Voices of Faith from a Life in the Church, is the topic of our discussion right now, a collection of interviews amongst the Catholic faithful, laity, consecrated virgins, religious priests, and bishops, taking a pulse of the sentiments of the Church on the ground. So, friend, we were talking earlier, and you made this comment about how here in the United States, we are also uniquely blessed by some very sound leadership at the level of the magisterial hierarchy. Our bishops, we have some truly noteworthy ones. And I mean, these are some whom we can write to the world about. You know, we have Bishop McManus, Bishop Cousins, Archbishop Naumann, Bishop Boyer, Bishop Vigneron, and the list goes on and on. We are just tremendously blessed here. Now, one of the questions that you yourself dealt with in the book is that there seems to be a lack of addressing some of the great scandals that are happening at the level of, say, the presidency and having a Catholic president. But what has been your take? What has been your take in terms of conversing with bishops about that particular issue?
Well, you know, privately, they're very critical of the current leadership precisely because there's a huge hypocrisy in, you know, carrying your rosary around publicly and getting Lenten ashes and then being the most aggressively pro-abortion president that in this country's history. I mean, there's all sorts of disconnections between Mr. Biden's professed Catholic faith and what he actually does in terms of his political preferences and actions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'd have to have the brain of a rock not to see the problem that goes with that. But bishops are in a position where they have to be prudent as well as courageous.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people don't understand that a lot of the time. I mean, I think there's a frustration among faithful Catholics that, you know, bishops are not out there excommunicating people.
Right.
But that has very unintended consequences that they have to take into account. And, you know, I think of the 30 guys that I talked with and that I compressed into the interviews in that particular chapter on the bishops. I mean, you really get a sense if you read those interviews of the kind of pressures that they're under and the limitations that they operate with and the kind of lives that they leave and the reasons that they decide the way that they do. So I'd really encourage people to read that before they're too critical of our bishops, because we actually have a crew of men that are doing the best that they can for their people under frequently very difficult circumstances.
Right. And one thing that I picked up in reading through that entire chapter was that, and I say this with a lot of charity, it's very, very easy to see that a lot of our bishops are not themselves master administrators, nor did they expect to be, nor should they be. They're pastors. Many of them are true leaders of the flock. They're shepherds of the souls of their people. And as administrators, they're great, they're good at what they do, but sometimes they find themselves thrust into true administrative conundrums. And so they exercise prudential judgment and prudence to the best of their abilities, in considering their fallenness as well. So comment on that a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'll give you a very specific example in a moment of what you're talking about. But I mean, it's absolutely essential, because, you know, priests don't go into the seminary thinking, gee, I'd like to run a parish and be the CEO of $1 million. No, they don't think that's not why people become priests. But they end up as a pastor doing that, and and even on a larger scale, that's what a bishop does. You know, he's part prophet and part teacher and also part administrator.
Mm-hmm.
And frequently that latter quality is not adequately taught in seminary. So what does that translate into? It translates into, you know, a bishop doesn't need to be a terrific CEO. What he does need to have are real skills at recruiting good, faithful people who can do those tasks in a responsible and worthy way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's very, very important. I mean, the man I worked for and whom I admired and admire enormously is, you know, Archbishop Charles Chaput in Denver and in mm-hmm. Philadelphia. I mean, he had an uncanny ability to choose, for example, really good CFOs. I mean, Dave Holden in Denver and Tim O'Shaughnessy in Philadelphia, they were spectacular guys, faithful Catholics, totally committed,
right,
highly competent. And it took a burden off the bishop. And if the bishop has the ability to recruit people like that and not try to do everything personally himself, it pays off. And I want to give you a specific example. You know, when Archbishop Chaput was named to Philadelphia, he knew that there were a lot of political and legal and morale problems in Philadelphia because of abuse issues from the distant past that had resurfaced and were causing an enormous amount of
mm-hmm.
difficulty for the church here. What he didn't realize until he had accepted and was on his way here was that we were also $300 million in debt. A strategic debt that came from bad not because the people administering the diocese were crooks, although there was also some of that, but simply people who were trying to do good things and not realizing that they weren't working anymore and they needed to be shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So you run into situations where dioceses, particularly on the East Coast, where the church is traditionally the strongest, where, you know, bad budget decisions have been made for 5 or 10 years, leading to millions and millions of dollars of debt that really cripple the church's evangelical outreach. And a bishop has to be able to know how to recruit people to fix that and when to say, close a ministry that simply has outlived its working life.
Mm-hmm.
And bishops are frequently good at starting things, or we all are this way, actually. I mean, it's one thing to start something. It takes a completely different character and mindset to close something because you know it's not working anymore and it's costing you things that you can't afford.
Right.
So those are some of the practical problems that I don't think most Catholics think about when they're thinking about what a bishop does. It's a mix of pastoral leadership, teaching, engagement with the people, but then also you have to go back to this bureaucracy called a parish or the bureaucracy called the diocese,
right,
and run it efficiently. And it's a tough job.
It is. And Archbishop Nicholas Chia, I was blessed to have a conversation with him when I was living in Singapore for 2 years. He was the predecessor of the present Archbishop William Goh. And he said, the moment a priest is made a bishop, the people place him on a pedestal and put a crown upon his head, but the crown is a crown of thorns, and heavy is the head that wears that crown.
Yeah, you know, there's a one of the guys that I quote, he's a really good friend, he's a good family friend, bishop friend, made this point that, you know, when you're an auxiliary, you can dodge some of the big decisions because you're not the guy in charge.
Mm-hmm.
You're there to help the guy in charge. When you're the bishop, when you're the ordinary, the guy who is in charge, it's like you're no longer really a person. You're the, quote, bishop. As you are no longer a human being. You're an office. And
right.
it there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, you're not seen the same way as you are when you're just an average priest or even a pastor. It's a consuming job.
Yeah.
That is just 24/7. And I saw it because, you know, I was chief of staff to Archbishop Chaffee for like 23 years. And when you see that on an intimate level, believe me, if you're not called to that by God, you don't want the job. It's just, it's very, very demanding.
That's right. And I wouldn't wish it on anyone, truly. And yet, we need people to do this job virtuously and well. And as you've mentioned in this book multiple times, that we truly are blessed with some of the best bishops in the world. They're outstanding
Oh, yeah.
Teachers, outstanding preachers and pastors. And some of them are just, like you mentioned, Archbishop Chaput, just brilliant administrators, recognizing in themselves an incapacity in certain areas. And so they elect the right people to facilitate the job of prudent administration.
Yeah, there's guys that I've had a blessing to know fairly well. I mean, Archbishop Gomez in L.A. was an auxiliary in Denver, and we got to know him very well. He's a good family friend and a wonderful guy. Bishop Dan Thomas in Toledo, Bishop Earl Fernandez,
mm-hmm.
In Cleveland, great guy. You mentioned Bishop Cousins, terrific person. I mean, there's a lot, you know, of course, Bishop Barron is a wonderful evangelizer.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a human trait. It's very easy to fall into the habit of criticism and distress. You know, I'm a melancholic by nature, and that's where I like to be. I like, mm-hmm. I like to be in that kind of every. You know, the glass is always half empty.
Right,
but it's not. You know, it's not. And we have a lot of problems in the church in this country, and they need to be named, frankly, and dealt with. And believe me, if you read True Confessions, you're going to get faithful people being very candid about what they see needs to be done and what they think is wrong. But that's not the spirit of the book, and that's not the spirit of the people I talked with.
Right.
They're people who are faithful and committed and finally very hopeful.
So, friend, since you opened up that can of worms, under 2 minutes here, but dealing with the COVID crisis as well as the sex abuse scandals were two of the big prevalent issues that
yeah.
all of the interviews seem to most of the interviews seem to highlight. And yet there really is hope in the pathway forward. Reading this book really gives you that.
Yeah, I think that, I think the clergy abuse crisis, the echo of that's going to be with us for another generation. But I don't think any institution in the United States has done more since the beginning of the crisis to really aggressively address and prevent abuse going forward. And I'm very proud of that because I saw it up close and personal in the job that I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think there was a second point that you, COVID. Yeah, you know, I think one of the strongest feelings that I encountered from from lay people was a real frustration that the bishops had caved so quickly in terms of cooperating with the government in shutting down churches, you know, while abortion mills and, you know, liquor stores stayed open. I think was a mistake, and I think a lot of very good people would name that as a big mistake, but that shouldn't be held too deeply against the bishops, because it was if everybody remembers, I mean, it was a hysterical time. And
that's right.
You know, the whole thing was overblown in a way that was absolutely unconscionable. The bishops were trying to protect their people. They made a bad choice, I think, in a lot of cases, but those things happen.
Right, and they were operating from a place of real ignorance, like the rest of us. We didn't know what we didn't know, and we didn't know what we were dealing with. But kudos to them for responding as true pastors and fathers. And, you know, we have the sacraments and the liturgies available to us like never before.
Yeah, that's true. And one thing I want you to keep in mind is that if you want a clear case of something that is dramatically better than it was 30 years ago, it's the American seminaries.
Mm.
That's just an absolute win. 30 years ago, the seminaries in this country were much weaker than they are now. And that's something to cling to, because the seminaries, by and large, are producing now really good men for the future who understand the cultural changes and challenges that we're going to be facing over the years. And I'm really proud of that. You know,
yeah.
I'm very proud of it.
And as one who's seen seminaries across the world, I can honestly tell you what we have in the United States is worth celebrating. Thank you so much for joining us, Fran. My guest, Francis X. Mayer, Senior Fellow in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, worked with Archbishop Charles Chaput for 23 years, and is the author of True Confessions, Voices of Faith from a Life in the Church. Stay tuned as we round off this hour. I'm Marcus Peter.